Hey everybody, so this is Cody from Cantus Firmus, and I am here with my good friend Jackson, who will be my guest and hopefully the vocal piece for the audience, since he is getting some of this information somewhat freshly as well.
Yeah,
and
I'm going in kind of cold on this one compared to the last podcast. I knew a little bit about what Cody was going to talk about, but this one I am going to be just as surprised as you are at the words coming into my ears and coming out of my mouth.
Well, that's great, because according to the statistics of my site, I think everybody else is pretty cold to this podcast too. So we can, I think you're a good stand-in. So before we start, I will mention Jackson is a talented artist and writer. He's a little bit between projects at the moment, but he's got a few things coming out soon. What he's kind of working on that's that you guys can get a hold of are Chocolate Book, which is an awesome blog where he eats chocolate. and also reads a passage in the Bible and gives his thoughts, and it's a very great site.
Every weekday. And it is a project between which I am not. It is going on right now. So you can check that out at chocolatebook.net.
Awesome. And the other thing you've been working on is the Let's Play page.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Hot pile of garbage. It's me and friends playing video games. And that's just the YouTube channel Hot Pile of Garbage. Do you have a link to that, Cody?
I think I used it last. I think I did find it and link to it the last time. I will put it in the what they call the show notes, which I just called the description.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And so they have a link to that as well. But you could also search it if you just, you know, are interested and haven't don't feel like going to look up the description.
Yeah. Yeah. We're gonna make all you listeners do the work here.
So what I'm talking about today is a pretty interesting idea called the documentary hypothesis, and it is a theory about how the Torah or the Pentateuch, or we'd call the first five books in the Bible, supposedly written by Moses, attributed to Moses traditionally, how those books kind of came together. And this is kind of the critical, what you might call liberal viewpoint on this issue. And there are two ways you can treat the Bible. You can either assume that it's trustworthy or assume that it isn't. And if you do the former, your approach is more straightforward. Sure, you still have to spend time reading the text carefully, comparing its data with data outside and that kind of thing. But broadly speaking, you know, you just say, the Bible can basically be trusted in what it affirms. You know, if a passage, you know, contains a claim that it was written by Moses, then sure, it was written by Moses. And, you know, unless you find some strong evidence to suggest otherwise. Now, the other approach is the one where you assume that it isn't. If you take that approach, you end up having to come up with more complicated models for understanding what's going on in the Bible, how it was put together, why people wrote what they did. There's a term that I think has a few different meanings, but it's sometimes been applied to the Bible in a slightly different way, the hermeneutic of suspicion, which is that as you read it, it's wise to just assume that whoever is writing any biblical passage is a liar who can't be trusted. more or less.
Wow.
So it might be a little aggressive, but that's
kind of going through life with an attitude like that.
So, In the field of Old Testament studies, and in particularly the Torah, the model which has been the most influential for critical scholarship is called the documentary hypothesis. And it asserts that behind the Torah, there were all these multiple written sources that were later edited together into the form that we find them now. Now, you may be wondering, well, how would they know such a thing? They must have found manuscripts of these original writings and can tell, you know, from that, you know, that the existed of these earlier forms before they were edited together. And you may assume that, but you would be incorrect. There is no explicit evidence for the documentary hypothesis. And how it actually came together and developed over time is pretty fascinating. Its roots were in an 18th century French scholar named Jean Astruc. And Astruc suggested that because there were different divine names in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, in Genesis 1 it's Elohim, in Genesis 2, God is called Yahweh Elohim. That implied that there may be two different authors, that Moses, because you still assumed Moses was an author, was the more or less the author of the Torah, edited together. That kind of idea was later applied to the rest of Genesis and to part of Exodus, the first two chapters, I believe, by a scholar named Johann Eichhorn. And Eichhorn basically said, you know, yeah, there are these two sources, the J source for Jehovah, which is a poor translation of Yahweh, and E for Elohim. And that became sort of the backbone of the historical sections of the Torah, that there are these two sources. In addition to parceling out texts on the basis of divine names, these scholars also pointed to doublets in the text, which would be like repetitions of the more or less the same material. So like Genesis 1 is a kind of a creation story. Genesis 2 is also kind of a creation story. They tended to assume that these creation stories contradicted. The conservative approach would be, well, actually, no, they complement each other. But, you know, basically, the contradictory approach would say, well, these are just two different sources that were kind of smashed together without really being thoughtfully cleaned up.
Yeah. Or like the scenario that you see a couple times throughout Genesis where the patriarch is going through the territory of some other king and tries to pass off his wife as his sister or what have you.
Yeah. And there's two different accounts of Abraham doing that. And there's also one of Isaac. What's interesting though on that point is that I think the critical consensus for the documentary hypothesis is that the two Abraham stories are written by two different authors, but the Isaac story is written by one of the authors who wrote one of the Abraham stories. So they don't view that, oddly enough, they don't actually view it as a messy contradiction that Isaac and Abraham, that happens to Isaac and Abraham, but they do view it as a messy contradiction that it happens to Abraham twice.
Yeah.
So it's somewhat subjective process, we'll say that.
Mm-hmm.
So then in the 19th century, which is where a lot of this action was, a scholar named Wilhelm Duet suggested a third source. So we have a J for Jehovah and E for Elohim, and now we have another one, D for
J for Yahweh.
What's that? Yeah, J for Yahweh. So we have this third source now, D for Deuteronomy or the Deuteronomist. And Duet suggested that the D source was actually manufactured by King Josiah and the high priest Hilkiah in the 7th century BC. So this was kind of a more conspiratorial reading of what happens in 2 Kings 22, where you read that Hilkiah finds the law of Moses in the temple, which had more or less kind of been forgotten, and, you know, brings it to the king, and then the king, you know, they basically bring it to the public, and it sparks this revival in Jewish piety. So instead of simply finding the law, Duet suggested that Josiah and Hilkiah wrote it themselves, and emphasized the temple in Jerusalem as central to Jewish worship for their own benefit. So you bring everybody to Jerusalem to emphasize the power of the king and of the high priest. Josiah did Deuteronomy is kind of the documentary hypothesis parallel of the Bush did 9/11 meme. We've got three sources, the J, E, and D. Now, following this okay so far?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'm following along.
Cool. It's still somewhat simple. I'm actually leaving out a lot, but I'm trying to simplify it as much as I can. So then a scholar named Hermann Hupfield, and most of these guys are Germans, by the way, split the E source into two different sources. And he created a fourth source, which is called P, which is short for the priestly source. And so his argument was that within this these sections that have the Elohim name, there seem to be two different concerns, and one of them appears to be a more priestly concern. And so, like, you know, a significant part of Leviticus and anything dealing with the temple or sacrifices, that's P. So this has created the standard fourfold division, the documentary hypothesis. And Hupfield's order of it was P, E, J, then D.
In terms of which came into being first and...
Yeah. So he would say the priestly is the earliest, because you have to have that sort of... you have to have that sort of basis of religion to begin with. Also, there's sort of an assumption that that kind of stuff would come earlier because there's sort of a primitive to sophisticated approach that tended to be used at that point, where there was almost this, I think Darwinism sparked this idea that there was also evolution happening in every other kind of field. Uh-huh. And so it began to be applied like in every field. So yeah, he said the priestly source was first. Then you have Elohim, and I think the argument there was that a basic common name for God that's more similar to other names for God in the ancient Near East.
Mm-hmm.
And then J comes next because that's a more...
Hebrew-specific.
Hebrew-specific, you got it. And then you have D at the end there. Now, that isn't the order that's used now. The order that's used now is suggested by a German scholar. I think maybe been suggested a little bit before him as well. I have to look at that. But he was basically the popularizer. He's the name who's more or less associated with the documentary hypothesis. And his name is Julius Wellhausen.
Mm-hmm.
And his assumption was that the priestly source was last. And that tends to be shared by most documentary hypothesis advocates today. But his rationale for that was that it came last because the Jewish religion had devolved into obsessing with the sacrificial system prior to the coming of Christ. He saw that as kind of a negative thing. I'd have to look at Wellhausen a little closer, but the assumption I think would be that he probably saw Christ in the same way that a lot of 19th century liberals did, that he was kind of wiping away all this religion stuff, and he was just kind of this really... I don't know. You know what I mean? This is kind of a certain...
Yeah, this hippie kind of guy.
Yeah, he's a...
Wouldn't it be great if we all just got along, man, without this religion stuff bogging us down?
Sure, Christ was a 19th century German liberal, is the idea. So that was his idea, and I recently heard a lecture from Dr. Christine Hayes, who's an Old Testament scholar in Yale, and she criticized what she viewed as his anti-Semitism. For that idea. And she basically said, well, you know, he was just a product of his time, and that's an unfortunate thing about him. But she seemed to think that modern scholars can use a documentary hypothesis without the kind of bias that those in previous generations could have. And that's a problem we'll get into later. okay, so here's what we got. Here's the deal. We have J, and that's dated to about 850 BC in the Southern Kingdom. And the J source, it is argued, describes God more anthropomorphically, and he's more intimately related to human beings. The E source is dated to 750, so 100 years or so later. It's assigned to the Northern Kingdom, and it's argued that it sees God as more distant, a little bit more, I don't know how exactly you describe it, but, you know, more godlike, more imperial. D is dated to around 621 BC and supposedly centralized Israelite worship in Jerusalem. That's kind of its emphasis. And then P's kind of reflects the concerns of a later priestly class. And that's dated to, I think there's kind of this idea that it developed sort of between Ezekiel and Ezra. So during the exile and kind of after it. Now, if that sounds like kind of a messy backstory, I'll remind you that I only gave the broadest strokes. There's so many reversals and variations that it would be kind of tedious to get into all of them.
It's actually more messy.
It's a lot more messy. And it almost is kind of funny when you look at it, because when you read the history of it, it makes you very suspicious of its validity. Because you're just like, okay, well, obviously this is an incredibly subjective, approach here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the background. And now I'll get more into the problems with the view as we have it. So first of all, what I just mentioned, the documentary hypothesis is based on so many subjective criteria that it's ultimately a kind of grasping at the wind. The assumption that modern scholars are less affected by bias as those from 200 years ago is so obviously false that it's almost laughable. The fact that we have different biases allows us to see the biases of those who came before us more clearly, but we're still just as likely as they are to miss our own particular biases. And I think that's pretty clearly what's happening with a lot of these critical scholars. They begin with an assumption of naturalism and of suspicion toward the Bible. And this kind of guides them to invent alternative viewpoints, which are difficult to really support on evidence, but they're viewed as almost necessary because it gives them a naturalistic kind of something to grab onto to try to understand what's going on in the Bible.
Yeah, it's like, well, there couldn't be a God. So when you look at these texts and it says something that makes sense, if you assume there's a God, then it must not actually make sense.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, it's just kind of a way to break it down and make it, I don't know, almost take away its edge, honestly. But so now why is the documentary hypothesis itself difficult to support from evidence? I'd give you a handful of reasons. To start with, there are numerous examples in the ancient Near Eastern literature of one God being referred to with multiple names. And this undermines the divine names criterion for slicing up the Pentateuch. Baal was also known as Alyan. The Quran, a little bit later, refers to Allah as both Allahu and Rabu. And in the Ebla tablets, there are two gods, Mikael and Enna'il, who go by those names, but they also go by what's essentially the same name, except Il is replaced with Yah. So it'd be Mikael and Enna'il. And that's actually particularly interesting because the God of the Bible is known as Yahweh and Elohim. Mm-hmm. So that same kind of ending that you see there shows up in the beginning of that name for God. In addition, there are plenty of examples of the wrong name showing up in the sections which the critics have segmented out. The name Elohim will occur in passages that I've defined as belonging to J, such as Genesis 3, also 16, and also 32. Yahweh occurs in passages that are viewed as E passages, like Genesis 22 and 28. The response to that is basically that, well, I guess a later editor who is a J editor put these passages in here or changed the name.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you ultimately have is, you know, you don't have any concrete evidence, but even the circumstantial evidence is so, you know, so warped that you can kind of just twist it. Well, okay, yeah, but it becomes like a just-so story. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, yeah, this is looks like a J passage, and it is a J passage, but even though it doesn't look like a J passage because the Elohim name that's here, but that's because the E author stuck it in. Something like that.
You have to put so many correcting factors and variables into your equation that you wonder if it wouldn't be best, that the data wouldn't be best described by some other equation entirely.
Yeah, it's a lot like just about any other conspiracy theory. There's always going to be some way to try to understand what's going on to explain away the data. That being said, I think probably the death blow to the divine names criterion is that the Greek translation of the Torah, the Septuagint or LXX, and it dates to within a couple hundred years before Jesus, it shows a different name. There are Greek words that are apparently the equivalent of the Hebrew names. And what's kind of fascinating is in almost 200 places, those names don't match in the Septuagint. And that suggests that, you know, because in textual criticism, certainly things can get lost or misconstrued. And there are times where the Greek Septuagint is looked at as possibly having a more ancient reading than the Hebrew Masoretic text.
Uh-huh.
And so if you want to try to make this big argument based on divine names, well, there's an awful lot of places where the Septuagint makes you question whether which divine name was actually used originally in a certain passage. So I would say that's a pretty strong negative for the divine names criterion in particular. I think you could ask the question, what does the divine name used in a given passage tell us? Is it completely arbitrary? Well, the critics would argue that, you know, the name Yahweh is often used in passages where God seems more intimate with humanity. He's described in more anthropomorphic terms. And I think that they're not too far off there. For instance, in Genesis 1, we find that Elohim brings all of the universe into existence. But in Genesis 2, it is Yahweh Elohim who takes a special interest in the creation of mankind and walks in Eden with Adam and Eve, and who also enters into covenant relationship with them. The idea that these two chapters represent different authors on the basis that they both give an account of creation can also be undermined on the basis of other ancient Near Eastern texts. For instance, 9th to 18th century BC, royal inscriptions of the kings of Urartu, that's U-R-A-R-T-U, in case anyone wants to look it up, follow a similar pattern to Genesis 1 and 2. They begin with an initial summary of, in this case, a battle, and then in the next section they go into specific details. And I think what you're seeing with Genesis 1 and 2 is, first of all, God is described a little bit differently in Genesis 1. He's majestic, he's distant, he's creating all the universe. And then it's mentioned offhand that, well, yes, he also creates mankind. Then in Genesis 2, you get into the specific details. It's more intimate. He walks in the garden with Adam and Eve. And not just that, but the idea that Genesis 1 and 2 were a doublet, that they tell the same story, they're trying to tell the same story, but they contradict, I don't think is correct. I think Genesis 2 is giving a more detailed approach to what one specific part of Genesis 1.
Yeah, it zooms in on mankind and who is only one man at that point, but consequently it uses a name for God that is associated with that sort of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, follow.
Yeah. And so that these two sort of ideas that are kind of used, particularly Genesis 1 and 2, where I think are often the kind of common examples that are used to support the documentary hypothesis, but the divine names criteria and the idea of doublets in the text are not really strong evidence for the documentary hypothesis, because we see them both in other ancient Near Eastern texts where there isn't really any suspicion that we're looking at two different authors who've been edited together. In addition, I would say there's also a great deal of circular reasoning in the documentary hypothesis. For instance, a lot of these critics will tell you that J and E aren't interested in issues of the temple or the sacrificial system. And so that's used as an argument for the documentary hypothesis. But you have to remember that they've defined any passages which discuss these issues as P passages. So if it looked like J or E were discussing those issues, they would say, oh, well, that's a P passage. And so what they've kind of really done is, because of these assumptions they've made about the development of the Israelite religion, they funnel those assumptions into how they cut up the text, and it just becomes circular reasoning. It doesn't really prove anything.
Uh-huh.
In addition, I want to note that the documentary hypothesis, while fairly popular, it's not the only view held by critical Old Testament scholarship for how the Torah took its form. So form criticism is a different example. It denies the existence of firm written sources which have been edited together, and it actually assumes a history of oral transmission leading up to the writing of the Pentateuch. That's just one example. There's other views as well. I think the documentary hypothesis is probably the most influential, though. Kenneth Kitchen, an Orientalist and Egyptologist by training, has also spent some time examining Old Testament scholarship. And he noted how much more distrustful and cynical it is of its primary sources in comparison to other ancient Near Eastern fields of scholarship. Critical Old Testament scholarship has a strong tendency to avoid harmonizing texts, so it'll instead exaggerate differences in text to create contradictions as a rationale to multiply proposed sources. And it will generally trust non-Old Testament sources over Old Testament ones when any apparent discrepancy seems to exist. For instance, it was assumed in Old Testament scholarship that the Babylonian king Belshazzar, mentioned in Daniel, never existed, since no other source seemed aware of him outside of the Bible. This was used to further their assumption that Daniel was written hundreds of years after it was claimed to have been and was not historical. For instance, in 1850, a German scholar named Ferdinand Hitzig said in his commentary on the Book of Daniel that Belshazzar was, quote, a figment of the writer's imagination. This critical position was changed after the Nabonidus Cylinder and Chronicle were discovered, I think about 4 years after the scholar said this, and they referenced Belshazzar and his position as co-regent. So, you know, I wish I had this other quote here, but I'd found another liberal scholar who had writing after this fact and basically said that, you know, Daniel is, of course, not historical. Of course, it's written hundreds of years after it says it is. But he also has an amazing historical memory because no other writer seems to have remembered Belshazzar. You know, no one else seemed to be aware that he existed. So, you know, writing at the time that Daniel was believed to have been written by the liberals.
Wow. And even, you know, even prior to the discovery of the, what was the thing that
the cylinder in the Chronicles, the Nebenitis.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Even before the discovery of that, it's quite an assumption to say that someone just imagined up a king,
you
know? Yeah.
And you do have example, like, so in, I want to say it's the Book of Judith, it's an apocryphal writing. Mm-hmm. You have a kind of a clear example of a contradictory viewpoint that can be pretty clearly shown to be incorrect by history, where Judith argues or claims that Nebuchadnezzar was the king of not the Babylonian Empire, but the Persian Empire. And so that one you could go, okay, yeah, so that's a pretty clear contradiction. But when you sort of go, okay, well, we haven't read about this king in our other sources here. We don't seem to be aware that he exists. So obviously Daniel's full of crap. You don't say that. You know, Kenneth Kitchen's point is, no, you just go, well, hey, Daniel might have some insight on this issue, and maybe we'll just be agnostic and until we know a little bit more.
Yeah, like if every time that someone brought up some person or thing that you'd never heard of before, you were just like, oh, I've never heard of that before. That must be some figment of your imagination. Then you'd never learn anything about anyone or anything.
Okay, so those are some of the problems with the documentary hypothesis. The traditional position is that Moses is the author of the Pentateuch. And I think that, in fairness, we should look at that issue as well. You know, are there any positive evidences for Moses as the author of the Pentateuch? And the answer is that there actually are some. To begin with, there are a number of passages which explicitly claim Mosaic authorship within the Pentateuch or the Torah, such as Exodus 17:14, Numbers 33:1-2, and Deuteronomy 31:9. In addition, there are other Old Testament passages which claim Moses as the author of at least portions of the Torah, such as Joshua 8:32, 1 Kings 2:3, and 2 Kings 14:6, in case anybody wants to look them up. So even if one doesn't want to hold the more conservative position of assuming that all of the Torah is Mosaic, apart from a few obvious exceptions, such as his death account, and maybe a few places which seem to suggest an update of place names from a later editor, there is at the very least evidence for significant portions of the Torah, which should be taken seriously as Mosaic, unless one has strong evidence against trusting the text. There are also some indirect evidences which suggest an author whose characteristics line up with those of Moses. For instance, the author is familiar with Egyptian names, titles, and geography. In contrast, he assumes some unfamiliarity on the part of his readers with Palestine. So, for example, in Genesis 13:10, the author, whoever he is, explains that the Jordan Valley, what it was like by comparing it to Egypt. This assumes that he thought his readers would know more about the geography of Egypt than the geography of Palestine. He also has a lot of familiarity with the geography of Sinai, which makes sense because they were traveling for decades in Sinai. So also many of the commands in the Torah regarding sacrifices and worship assume a movable tabernacle and not the temple, which would mark the worship of the Israelites after the time of Solomon in the 10th century BC. So if you want to argue that the priestly sources come much later, even though you're arguing that J is in 850, I think, and E is in 750, then why are the priestly sources assuming that there's this tabernacle traveling through the wilderness instead of a temple that exists in Jerusalem? In addition, There are commands assuming life within a sojourning camp, such as how one should defecate outside of the camp, how they should bury it, yada, yada, yada. And those don't make a lot of sense if they're written for a people who are settled within Palestine. On the other side, there are a couple passages that seem to refer to life that's more settled. I think a lot of those you'll find more in Deuteronomy, I want to say, but don't quote me on that. Makes some sense because it's kind of the book that's sort of supposed to be written for those who are kind of entering into Palestine. Exodus is kind of during the sojourn. Deuteronomy is sort of just before they're coming in.
Yeah, and so it's like, well, you're getting ready to settle down. Here's what you're going to need to do once you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for example, there's a reference to the you know, how kings should function. And even though kings hadn't come yet. And that's used as an argument for why the Torah should be thought of as later during the time of the kings. And you know, that's certainly a line of evidence. It's one piece of evidence, but it could also be that you know, Moses was foreseeing that as a possibility or something that was going to happen, since that was very common.
Yeah, it is sort of peculiar that the Torah in, you know, spots like that anticipates kings, even though you have that scenario very quickly on where Israel demands a king and God is like, no, that's a bad idea. I should be your king. You don't want a human king. And they're like, no, we do. And God's like, okay, it's your funeral.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I think certainly that's a line of evidence that could be brought up for an alternative viewpoint of how the Torah was put together. You could also view it as a later update. So, I mean, there are all these different solutions. I think the argument that the conservative is making, and someone like Kitchen would make, is that no other field of ancient Near Eastern scholarship treats the text with so much suspicion. There's always kind of an interest in trying to take the text as its word, unless you have a strong argument otherwise. And so, you know what, I would argue that there seem to be examples in the Torah of, like a place, so for example, there's a reference in Genesis to a place name called Dan, which doesn't seem to exist until the time of the judges. You could argue maybe it's a different Dan. But you know, there's decent, it seems to suggest that that's actually a later update from an editor who's trying to make sense of what the place name is for the reader who would be reading it in Palestine after it's settled. Uh-huh. And so, you know, there's different ways to look at that. I mean, you have a text that's been copied for hundreds of years and could have, you know, gone through sort of a process of canonization and reforming. But do you view that process as very minor? Or do you view that as, you know, totally bananas crazy? And so, you know, I think it's wise to, you know, give the text the benefit of the doubt until you have strong evidences to the contrary. And I think the documentary hypothesis goes way too far based on the limited amount of evidence that exists.
Seems like a reasonable conclusion to make. You know, it's sort of frustrating that apparently the ancient Hebrew culture didn't have the same approach to editorship as, you know, and documentation of changes that we do. At the same time, there's no reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, they didn't have Google Docs. Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, I think the specific arguments that are brought up for, you know, why this, you know, let's date this portion to this time and assume it had this kind of author, I think is so speculative. I mean, you can certainly speculate on that, but I think what's so odd is that it's not treated as speculative. It's treated as, you know, the assured conclusions of scholarship. And I think that's kind of primarily my issue, is that if you assume a more conservative viewpoint, you're kind of laughed out. Even though the conservative viewpoint is really just trying to take the text at the face of it until you have really strong evidences to the contrary.